It has very substantially upgraded its defense capabilities and is doing a great deal more.
The new U.S. Defense Secretary heads to Asia amid security concerns. It's Friday, January 27th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Be a part of our program by logging on right now to Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, weaker Asian economies seek new avenues of trade. Assessing the Rohingya situation in Myanmar. And we check out Indonesia's Lunar New Year. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The new U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis becomes the first senior Trump administration official to make a foreign trip. Mattis, confirmed by the Senate just last week, will make stops in Japan and South Korea. The Pentagon said the trip will underscore the commitment of the United States to its enduring alliances and further strengthen security cooperation. Mattis will visit Seoul on February 1st, Tokyo February 3rd. He has made reaching out to traditional allies a priority in his first days of speaking with the head of the NATO alliance and his defense counterparts in Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and New Zealand. During the election campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump called on both South Korea and Japan, who host thousands of U.S. troops, to shoulder more the defense burden. Brad Glosserman, executive director of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum think tank, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the trip comes at a time of tension in Seoul and Tokyo.
I believe that that reflects a sense of priority that is a product of American interests and, I think, a greater, certainly a powerful and compelling need for the United States to be engaged and to assuage the concerns of allies. It also could mean that they are anticipating an immediate challenge from that part of the world. You go to where you expect you're going to have to be doing something. And so they're laying, I think, groundwork for some of that as well as dampening tensions.
What are the challenges, China, North Korea, or both?
I think both. My sense is the immediate challenge from the administration is going to come from North Korea in the sense that China, I think, is more inclined to wait out the administration to see where it's going to go and not be, if you will, the first opportunity for the new president to throw down the gauntlet. My sense is that North Korea, on the other hand, has a more pressing need for international engagement.
Well, is this because of the intercontinental ballistic missile threat seems to be more imminent?
Imminent, I'm not sure is the right word. I think that there is the prospect of a test. And mind you, I think the official wording from the North Koreans has been merely that they've ended the preparations and that a test could come anytime. That doesn't mean that it's actually going to come. I think it's more along the lines that this is a North Korean administration that probably feels a greater need to command American attention and to see what the opportunities are and to try to shape events in ways that they think, rightly or wrongly, are more congenial to North Korean interests.
During the election campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump suggested that Japan share more of the burden for its own defense. What are the issues that Japan and the U.S. face on this trip?
Well, I think that's the immediate one, is the equitable burden sharing. And I think that's a longstanding American complaint that Japan has not done enough, and I think that reflects in many ways an outdated mode of what Japan is doing. It has very substantially upgraded its defense capabilities and is doing a great deal more in the interest of being a good alliance partner and contributor to security in the region. I think the Japanese very much would like to hear Secretary Mattis repeat the explicit commitment to defense of the Senkakus under Article 5 of the Mutual Defense Treaty, which both President Obama and former Secretary of State and Defense have given.
The trip's announcement came as China released a new list of items banned for export to North Korea as part of UN Security Council Resolution 2321, following a North Korean nuclear test in September. The banned exports include so-called dual-use materials and technologies that can be used in the manufacture of weapons, such as software programs and certain metals. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Russia flies bombers around Japan. Japan seeks reassurance about security alliance with the United States. Myanmar shrugs off international pressure over Rohingya crackdown. U.S. humanitarian aid goes to North Korea despite nuclear tensions. A defector says the North Korean regime is crumbling. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, and also check out our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Asian economies such as Vietnam and Malaysia, already facing weak growth in exports, are now bracing for more challenges amid growing protectionism. The recently released United Nations report, The World Economic Situation and Prospects 2017, says East Asian growth has been moderately positive. It says export growth in Asia remains weak, in line with global trends, but that domestic demand remains the key driver to regional growth. Economists say a climate of protectionism raises concerns as export trade has been a driving force lifting millions out of poverty across the region. The latest warning came this week following President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the 12-member Trans-Pacific Partnership. UN senior economist Jose Antonio Pedrosa Garcia says the key policy concern for Asia is the challenge to multilateralism, a cornerstone of economic growth in past decades.
We are seeing a rise of protectionism. We are seeing that initiatives that had absorbed a lot of work, such as the TPP, or much more recently the Paris Accords, are in danger. All these things raise a fundamental question about multilateralism. Is it in danger? Do we need to have better policy coordination?
Amortep Chawla, head of research office at CIMB Thai Bank, said a U.S. administration policy to promote domestic U.S. growth may come at the expense of exports from Asia.
Countries like Malaysia, Singapore, or even to some extent, Philippines, they export something like, especially Malaysia and Singapore, would export something that could compete with things produced in the U.S. So I would say that problems or some slowdown in exports would come from Malaysia and Singapore.
In a recent commentary, economists with the London-based group Capital Economics said Vietnam and Malaysia were set to be the biggest beneficiaries of the TPP, and so its demise represents a major blow. Pavita Pananad, a professor of international business studies at Thammasat University, expressed similar concerns about protectionism in global trade and business.
The rising protectionism that could possibly happen if he indeed put in the tariff on imports from other countries. So that would certainly will be one direct impact on international trade. And with that, the retaliation of other countries that could bring up the wave of anti-globalization, protectionist, and nationalist agenda. I think that is quite dangerous, it's dangerous for the world, but it is more dangerous for countries that have long been dependent on export, such as those in Asia.
She said any shift by the United States in long-standing policies toward Taiwan, which China considers a breakaway province, would lead to rising regional tensions.
Could make the region more regionally oriented, because now Asia would probably think that the opportunities to do business within the region has increased because of their need to look for alternative export markets.
Outside of trade, a U.S. policy to promote American employment would impact the Philippines, which has thrived on business outsourcing, a sector that has accounted for about 10% of national output. The sector, including in India, would be hard hit if American companies were called on to bring this work back to the United States. You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, Philippine President Duterte said suspects in the killing of a South Korean businessman caught up in the Philippines drug war will receive the harshest possible sentence. The president and the police have apologized for the incident. The program has claimed more than 7,000 lives. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy to have you with us today. Events in Myanmar's Rakhine State have deteriorated to the point where it's become the focus of international discussions on providing sufficient aid and ending what some call the Rohingya genocide. VOA Asia's Steve Miller speaks with analyst Hunter Marston and Human Rights Watch Asia Deputy Director Phil Robertson following the UN's special rapporteur visit with Aung San Suu Kyi.
Since 2012, The violence in Myanmar's Rakhine state has displaced thousands of people. According to the United Nations Human Rights Council, that number has surpassed 140,000. In recent months, videos of abuse by Burmese security forces have emerged, coupled by allegations of rape and the burning of Rohingya Muslim villages. These actions prompted ASEAN foreign ministers to gather in December 2015 to discuss the situation and a series of rallies led by Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak. Last week, Lee Yong-hee, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights for Myanmar, sat down with the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, to discuss the situation. Phil Robertson, the Asia Deputy Director for Human Rights Watch, says on Skype that such events show just how dire the situation is in,
particularly the areas around Mongda and Butidong, which were affected by the security sweep slash crackdown that took place after the original attacks against the border patrol. We're still seeing restrictions on humanitarian access, international humanitarians not being able to get into these areas. The security sweeps are still ongoing. Human Rights Watch found over 1,500 structures destroyed using satellite imagery. And now the authorities are undertaking a wave of demolishing so-called illegal structures, structures that were built without advance permission from the authorities.
Hunter Marston, an independent analyst who previously worked at the U.S. Embassy in Myanmar, adds that Lee Yong-hee's visit was somewhat of a good sign.
But the unfortunate reality is that Lee was not allowed to speak with just anybody. She was kind of kept to the pre-approved government list and not allowed into certain villages.
But Marston characterizes the results as
categorical denying of the situation, the reality on the ground.
The intense international focus of the situation in the Rakhine state and Lee Yong-hee's recent visit isn't enough, says Marston, to bring about an optimistic view of the situation, given that
it's very tightly controlled on the ground. Aung San Suu Kyi has clearly continued to insist on not using the term Rohingya to talk about the Muslim population in Rakhine state. There is room for improvement, of course, because things are quite bad.
Marston says there is hope if Suu Kyi and her government take a more proactive role, a thought echoed by Robertson.
I think that the Burmese government has to stand up. It has to basically confront the military and say, look, you cannot use these kind of rights-abusing tactics in a systematic way and expect us to remain quiet.
Marston says if ASEAN, and especially Indonesia, as the world's largest Muslim nation, engage closely with the Burmese government, change might occur. For VOA News in Washington, I'm Steve Miller.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia. China announced new items banned for export to North Korea. The ban mostly includes chemicals and alloys, but also covers machinery, aerospace engines, and cameras. This follows complaints that China isn't doing enough to exert pressure on Pyongyang. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. The lion dance has become a symbol of the Lunar New Year celebrations. VOA Indonesian correspondent Rivan Diastono takes us to a U.S. school for lion dancing near Washington.
In Chinese-American communities throughout the United States, the Chinese New Year Parade is one of the year's most anticipated events. One of the staples of any parade is the lion dance, an ancient tradition which has roots in an exorcism ritual using mythical figures such as this fierce lion to ward off evil spirits. Every year, the D.C.-based Chinese Youth Club plays a key role in preserving as well as introducing this tradition at the annual parade in Washington's Chinatown. Before the parade, the club practices every Friday night. Members, consisting of adults and children, including Jasper Jilu and Abigail Zaidan, diligently prepare for the new year. This year, it falls on Saturday, January 28th. The parade is the following day.
I I'd say the parade.
The parade? Why is that?
Because there are a lot of people watching.
A place where old people go.
The lion dance itself has been documented since the Tang Dynasty in the 7th century as a performance enriched by foreign influences, since lions are not native to China. Later, the tradition spread to other regions, such as Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and the Himalayas. The Chinese Youth Club, founded in 1939, has been actively engaging the communities in Washington through various cultural programs, including their famed lion dance. Now, the third generation performs this dance, teaching young members its intricate choreography and meaning. It might look easy, but the lion dance requires tip-top physical condition and superb acrobatic skills. The hardest move for Stephen Lee, who trains beginners, is to jump and stand on his partner's shoulders. We're going to share a secret. Sometimes even a pro like Stephen can't avoid accidents.
This building.
Oh, really?
Yes, we were practicing a headset, so I sat on someone's head, mm-hmm. and then we were attempting to do the shoulder stand. Mm-hmm. So I started to stand, and I slipped back, and I fell backwards. And I'm okay, though. It's maybe like 3 years ago.
Fellow trainer Jason Lee has been lion dancing since he was 6 years old. This is an important tradition in his family. He believes that learning and preserving it has enriched his identity.
I want to pass on what I've learned to other, not necessarily Chinese members, but other people in the community. Doesn't matter what ethnicity it is, it's just to get you the exposure.
A common goal shared by fellow members and their families.
This is part of our culture, and you know, even though I'm Asian and I was born in Taiwan, mm-hmm. I was never given the chance to participate in a lion dance. Mm-hmm. And as a kid, I was always very envious of other children, other adults who got to dance.
Even thousands of miles away from their homeland, the Chinese communities in the United States are optimistic that this ancient dance will be preserved as more and more young generations embrace their cultural roots. From Gaithersburg, Maryland, Rifan Dwi Astono, VOA.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Malaysian budget air carrier AirAsia says U.S. authorities have cleared its flights to American airports, the first low-cost Asian airline to do so. AirAsia pioneered the low-cost model in Asia, delivering rapid growth as it undercut bloated legacy carriers with its no-frills approach. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, just before New Year's festivities begin, we turn to VOA Indonesian reporter Virginia Gunawan for the holiday and how it's celebrated in Indonesia.
Across the world where I've been and have seen the Lunar New Year, it's basically the same. It's where the time when people and their family gather up and visit their home. But there's one thing that is very special in Indonesia is that you go around to your relative's house on the day of the new year. It's what we call an open house. Mm-hmm. So you visit them and then you say Happy New Year, and it's the time when you gather up and you say, sometimes you apologize for the past mistakes. And then the most awaited for kids are the red envelope where you get money.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Everybody likes to get a little bit of money. That's nice. And also new clothes, too?
Yes, new clothes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it has to be bright colors.
Okay.
In Indonesia, the department stores or shopping mall, they always have bright colors everywhere, red especially. And you can see everywhere in the shopping center, they start giving out discounts and giving out red envelopes for shoppers who come to their stores. But particularly around the past 10 years, it becomes more oriental looking in sense of the design of the clothing. So it's fun.
For people who live in the United States, of course, we're very familiar with Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Similar time when families get together and there is, of course, food involved.
Yeah. Well, there are, at least from my tradition, from my family's tradition, is that you always have to have 8 courses. Yes.
That's a lot.
Yes. And
do you not eat the day before to have room for it?
No, it's sort of like you do that, right?
With maybe.
Thanksgiving, sometimes
maybe I do.
Well, with 8 courses, it has a different symbol for every courses that comes out. Let's say with fish, my mom always cooked fish for Chinese New Year. It symbolized the luck and prosperity of it. And then she insists that I have to eat all the 8 courses. Yeah, everyone has to have at least one of those 8 courses. We don't drink alcohol because my mom doesn't want me to drink alcohol.
Okay.
And it's also somewhat difficult to find alcohol in Indonesia because it's a Muslim country. Mm-hmm. So we substituted with soda, a lot of sugar.
That's nice.
Yeah,
yeah, sure. Yeah. Have you noticed any real differences between celebrating it in Indonesia versus the United States?
I don't see a lot of people doing the open house here. Mm. Usually here it's just like everyone gathers at one family's place and then everyone just have the gathering there. But in Indonesia, we kind of like to travel and to see someone's house and to kind of invade them in their private space in that sense and coming over and being the guest, I guess. I think that's the major difference.
We wish a very happy new year to everyone in Indonesia and across Asia, and especially to Virginia Gunawan. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more from our other Asian cultures around the building here at VOA as the new year progresses. In fact, this is our last chance to say Happy New Year before the actual date. Xin Ning Kuai Le, and Happy New Year. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can always like us on Facebook by that very same name, VOA Asia. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. Our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our VOA Asian team, Steve Miller, Ali Ogden, Eli Zimmerman. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day and a great new year. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After 22 years of autocratic rule under former President Yahya Jammeh, the Gambia has a new president, Adama Barrow. President Barrow's inauguration took place on January 18th at the Gambian embassy in Dakar, Senegal, due to concerns about his safety in Gambia. After initially accepting his electoral defeat in early December, Mr. Jammeh suddenly changed course, refusing to step down. He then attempted to challenge the election results in court, and when that failed, declared a state of emergency. The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, immediately condemned the attempt by Jammeh to cling to power. Following weeks of high-level engagement by ECOWAS and other regional heads of state, the group underlined their commitment to Gambian democracy by organizing a multinational mission to enforce Gambia's electoral results should Mr. Jammeh continue to refuse to hand over power. Following the stationing of these forces on the Gambian border and intense last-minute mediation by regional leaders, Mr. Jammeh finally agreed to depart peacefully on January 21st. This has paved the way for President Barrow to return to the Gambia imminently. The United States welcomes the ongoing peaceful transition of power in the Gambia and congratulates President Barrow on his inauguration. Mr. Jammeh took office in 1994 after a coup and imprisoned numerous journalists and political opponents during his tenure. President Barrow has vowed to release all political prisoners and to get to work on improving the Gambia's economy. The United States applauds the commitment to democracy and the restraint shown by the Gambian people over the past weeks and appreciates the decision by Mr. Jammeh to depart peacefully. The United States commends the Economic Community of West African States and other regional partners for their leadership in addressing the situation. The United States echoes President Barrow's call for Gambians to unite and work together as brothers and sisters for the future of the Gambia. The United States is proud of our close ties to the people of the Gambia and looks forward to working closely with President Barrow and his team to achieve the aspirations of all Gambians.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.